Now, Wisconsin Republicans are rushing to pass over a dozen election reform bills before the end of the legislative session next month. The bills would have wide-ranging effects on how elections are conducted here in Wisconsin. Among other things, they would give lawmakers power to block federal funding and guidelines, make it more difficult to obtain absentee ballots, require extra paperwork for housebound people to vote absentee, ban private funding for elections, and more. Lawmakers around the country are making similar moves as the midterms approach, and former President Donald Trump pressures Republicans to amend election laws. The bills are likely to be vetoed by Democratic Governor Tony Evers. We're talking about GOP-proposed changes to election law in Wisconsin, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What pandemic-related voting changes do you think we should keep? Which ones should we get rid of? What are your thoughts on the way absentee voting works in Wisconsin? Should the government automatically mail registered voters absentee ballots, or should voters have to apply for them? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Sean Johnson is the State Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio and co-host of WPR's Politics Podcast. Sean, welcome back to Central Time. Do we have you, Sean?
Hey, Rob.
There you are. Okay. Sean, state Republicans, as I said, are proposing a lot of changes in election laws. Why are we seeing this rush of proposals right now?
I think you could probably point to a couple reasons. I mean, the legislative session is running out, and you have Republican sponsors of these who say and, you know, believe that the Wisconsin Elections Commission, the agency that runs elections in Wisconsin, has sort of taken it upon itself too often to make changes to election law. And so if you're going to make a change to any of these things, now's the time you got to do it. But then there's obviously very big political reasons that would be driving this too. This is something that they want to potentially use against Governor Tony Evers in his reelection bid. And then, you know, the biggest reason, I think, arguably, is that former President Donald Trump has never really stopped talking about the 2020 election and making, you know, the false assertion that he won battleground states like Wisconsin. And so with those repeated statements from Trump, you have a real push among the Republican base to do something about elections. And, you know, even Republican lawmakers who say Trump has gone too far in his statements will concede that they are pushing these bills in part because of the way, you know, their voters feel about elections.
You mentioned a lot of these bills center around the work of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Let's take a moment, Sean, to meet the WEC, the agency that runs elections in Wisconsin. Can you give us the origin story?
Yeah, I mean, it's not that old, really. It was created less than 7 years ago because Republicans who ran state government at the time did not like its predecessor, the Government Accountability Board. Government Accountability Board was created, you know, not too many years prior to that. It was run by nonpartisan judges. It was disbanded after it launched an investigation into former Republican Governor Scott Walker's campaign and, you know, several high profile Republican donors. It was replaced as a bipartisan board. So there's three Republican appointees, three Democratic appointees. This was not by accident. And this board does deadlock a lot on controversial issues. Although we should say that in 2020, you had some bipartisan votes to make changes to election policies in Wisconsin so that the state could continue to hold elections and continue to offer people the vote against, you know, circumstances that we'd never experienced before.
Now, some of these Republican proposed changes for the Wisconsin Elections Commission would take those instances where the commission issues guidelines on how elections work in Wisconsin, try to solve the gray areas, and say a legislative committee can step in and review those. What kind of change, what does that change look like?
Yeah, so it would give more power to this committee that is called the Joint Committee for the Review of Administrative Rules, which is a mouthful, but it's a pretty powerful committee in Wisconsin. And as the name suggests, they review administrative rules, which are policies that have the They're not laws, but they have the force of law. And so those are supposed to go to this committee, which can make changes to them. And they can, you know, the committee can also use parliamentary tactics to block or delay these things from taking effect. So if you have an elections commission that is doing this stuff, as you know, guidance is the word. Guidance doesn't have to go to this committee. And so this committee of Republican lawmakers cannot block guidance. But under some of these plans that are moving through the legislature now, guidance would be rules. You know, it essentially let the committee decide, we are going to take that up and we're going to block it. So it gives the legislature a lot more power to have a say in what is election policy in Wisconsin and what isn't.
Some of the new laws involve things that the Wisconsin Elections Commission had issued as guidance over the last few years, Sean, and passing laws to say, no, that is guidance you can't do. What kind of concrete changes would that involve?
There's quite a bit there in terms of what the agency has done recently as guidance. I mean, one that comes to mind, and actually, the commission is actually kind of scuffling potentially with Republican lawmakers over this right now, even without these bills, is the guidance that was handed down on how to handle witness forms, the certificates that accompany absentee ballots. So when people mail back an absentee ballot, it has to be witnessed, that somebody has to fill out their name, their address, and sign these forms. And what the commission has said since 2016 under a bipartisan vote was that clerks, if they know, if they know these certificates are missing information and they know what that information is, they can cure these forms. They can fill in that information. The vote still gets counted. What one of the bills that lawmakers are considering now would do is say that if you're missing really anything, if you're missing the voter's first name, last name, their hometown, their street number, their street name, any of that stuff, if the voter's information or the witness's information is wrong or missing, the ballot does not get counted. So what does that mean? If you look at how many ballots were missing that information in the last election, you could be talking about potentially hundreds of thousands of ballots that don't get counted because they're missing, a last name or a city, stuff like that.
Talking to Sean Johnson, WPR's State Capitol Bureau Chief, looking at a package of election laws being worked on by Republicans in the state legislature. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Andrew is with us in Green Bay. Andrew, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
What'd you want to bring up, Andrew?
I have kind of like two separate things, but on the same spectrum. It seems like there's both on the people who are voting and then the way that the people who are getting voted on get our attention. So with people voting, it seems like we're almost being discouraged to vote, when I don't understand why we can't just use one piece of information, our social security number, that theoretically every single person has. That should be all the proof you need to vote. Who cares about your name? You have a number assigned to you anyway. So why not just go with that? And then on the other side, with campaign financing, why can't we look to our European friends and say, okay, why do some people get to spend $300 million on a political war chest to get our attention? Why don't we have a set limit of what we can spend on a campaign that'll allow for not just Republican or Democrat, and maybe break us out of this partisan drivel and competition that we've seen for the past 100 years.
Andrew, thanks for the call. First, Sean, I don't know if anybody's proposing using the social security numbers to make it easier to vote, but what in these election proposed changes, what kind of things would make it either harder or easier to access different ways to vote?
You know, there was there's a lengthy hearing on these bills yesterday, and there was talk of there are forms you fill out where you, the social security number or digits of your social security number can be used. But I think if you look at big picture, there definitely is a push to there's no way of, I guess, getting around the fact that these bills would make it harder or add more obstacles to voting absentee. You know, so they're not removing the option of voting absentee, but they are making it more difficult. So like there's a bill that would, right now, you can request an absentee ballot be sent to you for every election in a given calendar year. So you could say, I want one just for the spring election, the spring primary, the August general. Just fill out the form. As long as the Elections Commission has your photo ID on file, you can get sent these forms by your clerk for these elections and not have to worry about it. Under a plan in the legislature, you could still get absentee ballots for those elections, but you'd have to apply each election for a new ballot, and you'd have to upload your photo ID for each election too, which has, you know, we know has created problems for some voters. So it's not shutting the door. It just is putting up a bit of a hurdle when it comes to doing this stuff.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about a slate of election change laws that state Republican lawmakers are pushing to pass before the end of the session next month. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you live or work in a residential care facility or nursing home? Some of these laws involve that. Did the pandemic impact your ability to vote? Are you someone who can't travel independently because of a disability or illness? How do you vote? Do you worry about these changes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about many proposed changes to election laws that Wisconsin Republicans are trying to pass before March. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your comments about how we vote in Wisconsin, changes you want or don't want to see made. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Bob is with us in Stoughton. Bob, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. You know, when you vote, it's not just the issue about voter ID or not. It's the fact that you have to have your current address on the ID, or they won't let you vote unless you have a piece of mail, like a utility bill. It can't just be any old piece of mail. And I think that's a big thing that I've seen people, you know, rejected from the voting lines all the time for decades now. And, you know, I understand why people have doubts about certain elections. Like, I had doubts about 2000 and 2004 or some of that old Prosser-Kloppenburg election. You know, sometimes individuals can do fishy things. And I think that, you know, we do need a closer look at the elections. I think allowing people to vote for a longer period of time and double-checking all the votes should be. I mean, you look back to the elections back in the 1800s, the elections used to go for, gosh, weeks on end and everything. And, you know, and Epstein didn't kill himself.
Bob, thanks for most of the call. Sean, your thoughts on Bob's thoughts on ID, matching current addresses, things like that. Anything in the new laws that would affect that?
So it's been a while since I've written about this, but I'm pretty sure that when you show your photo ID at the poll, they're not like making sure that your address matches up with the address in the poll book. That said, there are bills in this Republican package that would, I guess, make sure that those addresses did match. That there would be, in one of the bills, there would be a requirement that the state's voter registration database matches up with a database that is maintained by the Department of Transportation. And this would be a new match. It's not, it's not like the database matches that, you know, you may have heard us talk about in this program before. Mm-hmm. And so I think you could see a situation where if one of those addresses did not match, voters would be notified, but it'd be kind of on them to fix it. And they could very easily be, you know, dropped from voter rolls under that proposals. I mean, as far as scrutinizing, you know, the election and taking a closer look at the election, like the caller mentioned, I think it's fair to say that this, you know, 2020 presidential election it's still being looked at, but it has had a pretty close look. You know, there was a partial recount, a recount of the vote in Dane and Milwaukee counties. There was the audit of the election that, you know, election workers do after every statewide race like this. There was an audit by the Nonpartisan Legislative Audit Bureau, which did not find widespread fraud. It did find a number of instances where it said the Elections Commission, you know, exceeded its authority, should have gone to the legislature to get stuff approved. I think that's kind of the, you know, a theme of that audit. But you haven't seen widespread fraud in, you know, any credible investigation.
Let's go to Steele next in Appleton at 800-642-1234. Steele, hi.
Yeah. My question is, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, I did so much time. It was computers doing it. And after the stuff, all of a sudden we have to collect all the computers and have the military hide them in Fort Knox. And why don't we just have a piece of paper and you mark a crayon across it and maybe have young people count the votes instead of people just sitting there.
Steele, I gotcha. So we have paper ballots, Sean, I think everywhere in the state now, electronic vote tabulating machines. But there was a concern back in the day, I think as Steele was alluding to, that if you didn't have the paper, then you can't go back and double check. Well, we know we had recounts in Milwaukee and Dane counties, for example. We still have those paper ballots.
Yeah, that was something when you started to see voting machines used more widely in Wisconsin. There was a push to have an accompanying paper ballot with the electronic ballot. And so that is something that you have in Wisconsin. You know, but counting these votes, you know, it takes a lot of time, I will say. And you saw a lot of focus on just that aspect of the election in 2020. You still hear the, you know, former President Trump talk about complaining about the vote count not coming out until like 3 a.m. in Milwaukee. It came out at that time because they used in this election several high speed vote tabulating machines, you know, in order to hit that mark. So it's I think there would be a trade off for everything. If you had hand counting, we'd be wondering for days what had happened, given the influx of absentee ballots in the last election.
My understanding, Sean, is Milwaukee County, for example, used some grant money, private grant money, to buy some of those or defray the costs of some of those high-speed counting machines to get it out when they did. Another change, and this is being proposed as a constitutional amendment in part, would block that kind of grant. So what's in the works there?
Yeah, and I think if you're looking for which of these proposals has kind of the most partisan consternation behind it, that this might be the one. Republicans want to ban future private election grants like the ones that were given to clerks across Wisconsin, but primarily in five of the largest cities by a foundation, not-for-profit run by the that's funded by Mark Zuckerberg, the Facebook founder. So these grants paid for stuff, as you mentioned, like those vote counting machines in Milwaukee. It paid for PPE for poll workers, you know, protection as they conducted this election during the pandemic. It helped pay poll workers because in the April election of 2020, a lot of the older poll workers who had worked elections in the past did not want to show up and when they could run the risk of being sick at that election. So there's a lot of stuff that money went toward, and the cities that took it said, look, if we're going to run elections like we need to under these circumstances, we're going to need money. The Republican counterpoint is we don't need, a wealthy donor coming into the state and deciding, you know, which cities get more money, which cities get less. They have proposed this as a bill before. It was vetoed by Governor Tony Evers. They've got it in a bill again this time. That's likely going to be vetoed. But a constitutional amendment would be required to be approved by two consecutive sessions of the legislature and then voters. So it would sidestep the governor. But, you know, that's a no easy task to amend the Constitution and wouldn't take effect immediately.
Yeah, for all this other stuff, Sean, you just mentioned vetoes. Is it expected that if any or all of these pass the legislature, Governor Evers would veto them?
There are some elements of the bills that are kind of, you know, boring, for lack of a better word. They're a little micromanaging of, you know, the way that we run elections, but that's probably partly because some of them were drafted by a former clerk, State Senator Kathy Bernier. So she has ideas on how very, you know, particular details of the election process should work. That said, I just don't know that there's anything that the governor's going to sign, because some of these uncontroversial ideas or less controversial ideas are in bigger bills full of very controversial stuff. And Evers has given every indication that he's going to veto those. They're pretty relevant, though, because obviously he has his own election later this year. You have Republicans running against him, Rebecca Clayfish and Kevin Nicholson, who have said that they would probably have, they've indicated they would sign bills like these. And in fact, they have said they would dismantle the Wisconsin Elections Commission altogether. So even if it's not going to become law under Governor Tony Evers, it's relevant to think about, because this is the kind of stuff that could become law, you know, if there was a different governor.
Sean, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
Sean Johnson is the State Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio and co-host of WPR's Politics Podcast. He joined us for a look at new election proposals. Now, Wisconsin is home to thousands of lakes. Many of those have beaches, boat docks, and or cabins nearby, but some are still undeveloped, or as our next guest calls them, wild. He spent years looking through maps and satellite photos to create a definition for what makes a lake truly wild. Then he set out with his canoe and visited nearly all of them. Along the way, he took note of the animals and plants he found and dove into the natural history of these bodies of water. Have you explored some of the state's undeveloped lakes? Where are some of your favorite natural areas in Wisconsin to get out on the water? What does the experience do for you? Let us know your story. Email centraltime@wpr.org or tweet us at @centraltimewpr. John Bates is a naturalist and author from Manitowish. His latest book is Wisconsin's Wild Lakes, A Guide to the Last Undeveloped Natural Lakes. He recently talked to WPR host Lee Rayburn.
So, John, let's start with a simple question. What compelled you to write this book?
Several things. One was my own personal sense of adventure. I love going to wild places that few people have ever been to or go to now. I find a lot of joy in being in peaceful, quiet places. So that sense of adventure of just traveling around the state was enticing. And I really believe in the old statement of putting yourself in the way of grace. And that is really what happened in this 4 years of messing around all around northern Wisconsin. Put myself in the way of grace a lot, in the sense of coming to extraordinarily beautiful, peaceful places and trying to briefly be a part of those places. So there was that from a personal standpoint. And then from a writing standpoint, I wanted to do this because I really believe that the way we protect the natural world is through our love of places. We only protect what we love. We won't sit in front of bulldozers or write letters to congresspeople or act in a way that can create change unless we really are passionate about things. So my hope is that getting people to some of these wild places will enhance and deepen their love of these places such that they will work to conserve them and potentially to try to entice the DNR to and the feds to purchase more wild lakes. So because we really don't have that many. So
Well, forgive me for thinking this, John, but your love of our wild lakes in Wisconsin comes through in your book. And I have to wonder if there is an unintended consequence that you could have these wild lakes may not be as wild as they used to be once they catch on.
Well, that's a legitimate concern. We are very capable of loving places to death, and we've seen that happen in many other places. I would counter that, the opposite side of the coin being that my hope being the people will fall more deeply in love with the places by having visited them and will then work to conserve them. So Maybe there's an inherent risk that some places may get more use than they have. I'm hoping that that use translates into better conservation, more political action, deeper love.
And one of the things you document in Wisconsin's Wild Lakes, John Bates, is, you know, how many people you see out there, how many tourists come out there, or how much portaging you have to do to get there in the first place.
Right. So a lot of these lakes, not too many people are going to be that crazy enough to portage into, to be honest. I don't. And in fact, there were 10 lakes out of all that we went to, which was somewhere in a range of 138 lakes. There were 10 lakes we never even got to because we weren't willing to suffer enough to get to them. You know, you had to cross a half mile of bog or the road. The old road in was completely grown over, and it would have been a bushwhack of a quarter mile or more. So we left 10 lakes that I describe in there and say, you know, we never got there. Good luck.
You sure can. John Bates is a Wisconsin naturalist and author. He wrote the new book, Wisconsin's Wild Lakes, here on the Ideas Network. He's our guest. And let's take a step back for a second here, John, and because this debate comes up when we hear Minnesota and Wisconsin fighting over who has the most lakes, and this would go into John Bates' definition of a lake. How do you see a lake?
Yeah, so Wisconsin is said to have over 15,000 lakes. You need to temper that with the fact that over 6,000 of those lakes aren't even named. They're so small. My understanding is that those 15,000 the number comes from lakes 2.2 acres or larger. So those are, you know, what's the difference between a pond and a lake? Who knows? Minnesota defines lakes as anything larger than 10 acres. So one way or another, Minnesota wins the battle easily of having far more lakes than we do based on defining the lake anyway as 10 acres or more, or even larger at 25 acres or more.
Well, in your experience, do you think that definition is fair? Because it sounds like there were a number of lakes that you traversed in your book that were smaller than 10 acres.
Well, there weren't actually.
Really?
All the lakes that I have in the book are 30 acres or larger. That was an arbitrary definition that I worked with, because to go to all of the smaller, really tiny pothole lakes would never have happened. I would have died. I'm 70 years old now. I don't think I would have made it. You had to draw a line somewhere. I wanted to have lakes included that were large enough that if you put a kayak or canoe on, that you would have a paddle of, you know, at least 15, 20 minutes to go around the periphery of the lake. You know, a little 3 acre or 4 acre lake, there's not a whole lot of water. And so it was just an arbitrary definition that I used.
So we have John Bates' definition of a lake. What do you consider a wild lake? Because there are some where you have tourists, there are some where you have fishermen, there are some where you have hunters. What's a wild lake to you?
Yeah. Well, again, an arbitrary definition on my part. So I used a number of criteria. One, the most important to me was totally surrounded by public lands. So that all of these lakes, you will not see a single private home on. However, you may see a state or federal campground on it. So you might see a camper or something along a shoreline on some of these. You may see a dock into the water at a boat landing. And on a few of the lakes, in fact, there are either electric motors allowed, or on two or three of the lakes, motorboats are permitted. Nonetheless, they are completely undeveloped, publicly owned lakes, and thus are wild by my definition of non-privatized.
John Bates, our guest, naturalist and author of the new book, Wisconsin's Wild Lakes. And John, give us some idea here of how our human ecology and modern technology has affected Wisconsin's lakes and their environs.
The very simple and obvious statement is that on a developed lake, you have less canopy cover along the shoreline, less shrub cover along the shoreline, and less understory cover, because people have spent a small fortune, the family jewels, to purchase a shoreline property, and they want to have a viewscape of that lake. And in doing so, in altering the shoreline vegetation, they alter the bird population, they alter the frog population along the shoreline, by taking out woody debris along the shoreline so they have more space for swimming and boating. They're altering the fish populations and aquatic insect populations. So there are consequences to our love of water and our development of water. So and there's consequences to the use of motorboats on water and stirring up sediments in shallow areas and wave erosions along shorelines. So these things are easily noted along developed lakes. And one of the differences, of course, in a wild lake is that shoreline is still wild. And that was one of the beautiful things that I really enjoyed. A number of lakes of, you know, going along these shorelines and seeing, for instance, trees that have fallen into the water, and they've been there so long, they've been colonized by mosses, and then the mosses have been colonized by bog plants, and you have this kind of a mini bog community.
Yeah, one of the places you detail this, John, is in Dry Lake in Vilas County, and they're these bryozoans. Is that what they're called?
Yeah, that's exactly what they're called. Yeah, they're moss animals, and they look like a giant brain, basically. Something from outer space. I've had many people over the years call me up and say, "What in God's name is this thing I just found in our
found
lake?"
A brain.
Yeah, it's a big blob. It looks like a gelatinous mass, and it's kind of hard. But they're really odd, bizarre creatures. They're made up of this colony of things called zoids. You got to look at them under a microscope, and they have these little cilia, kind of hair-like tentacles that they extend out in the water, and they filter feed out of this blob. They're just bizarre and unique and really specific to cleaner water. So if you do have them, that speaks well for the quality of your water.
We're listening to a talk between WPR host Lee Rayburn and naturalist John Bates. His latest book is called Wisconsin's Wild Lakes. He's visited almost all of them in the state and is sharing what he found. If these types of areas are important to you, let us know. Have you explored any undeveloped lakes here in the state? What's the experience like for you of being alone on the water? Do you worry about these types of lakes being preserved for the future? You could email centraltime@wpr.org or tweet us at @centraltimewpr. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're listening back to a conversation with John Bates. He's a naturalist and author for Manitouish. He and his wife explored almost all the state's untouched bodies of water and put the experience in his latest book, Wisconsin's Wild Lakes. Here's the rest of his talk with WPR host Lee Rayburn.
One of the other aspects that you mention in your book, John Bates, which is Wisconsin's Wild Lakes, is the decline in our loon population and going back to our encroachment on natural habitats and where we meet natural wildlife. You know, you have these moments in your book. It's just you and the canoe and the sound of the loon. And you mentioned grace at this when we began the conversation, and that's what it sounds like in my head. But what can be done with our wild lakes, with what we have left of the natural habitat in Wisconsin, to restore the population of loons in our state?
A fellow named Dr. Walter Piper in Oneida County has been following upwards of 200 lakes in Oneida County for, 30 years now. And what he's finding is a decline, not in the adult population, but in the juvenile population that's returning, and a lack of successful reproduction in chicks, a less robust reproduction. Anyway, he's unsure what the causes are. So caution is always the principle one needs to approach these things with. We need to manage all the lakes that we have that have loons on them as carefully as we can. And for the most part, I think we are. Got to limit motorboat use anywhere near a loon nest. Got to manage water levels if there's a dam on a lake or a river that's increasing water during the spring can flood out a nest. There's a host of things that we can do, but the problem with loons is they're a migratory bird, and they're going down to the Gulf of Mexico for 3 years before they return. And there's a lot that's going on down there too, and in places in between. So as with all birds that are migratorial, the issue of conservation becomes muddy. We can't just protect everything here in Wisconsin. We have to protect everything between here and wherever they end up in a wintering ground.
You also, in your book, repeatedly refer to the water levels in the state of Wisconsin's lakes and how they run on about a 13-year cycle. But in the last 4 years, those water levels have been pretty high. And you allude to what that can do to a loon nest. What are some of the other effects that you saw as you were paddling around with the high water levels?
Yeah, boy, I found, particularly on seepage lakes, these lakes that don't have a lot of don't have any inflow or outflow of water that are particularly receive their water from precipitation, because we've had so much precipitation in the last decade. They're like 3 feet higher than the ordinary water level, so the shorelines were drowned. Lots of shrubs and trees, I mean, white birches, white pines around the shoreline, they're standing in a foot or two of water. It's pretty crazy actually looking. So there's a lot of dying going along, happening along the shoreline of these plants. And a lot of aquatic plants that, you know, are ordinarily just off the shoreline in a foot of water are now in 4 feet of water, and they're not necessarily adapted to being in deeper water. So you're seeing a bit of a change in composition of plants. But this year, this summer, precipitation was way down, so a number of the lakes came down from where they were. I was talking to a fellow actually last night about a lake, and he said it was 50 inches above normal high water mark, but it had come down 12 inches this year. Well, that's great, but it's still 38 inches above where it's supposed to be. That's a lot of water up onto the shoreland. Yeah.
John Bates is our guest here on the Ideas Network, a Wisconsin naturalist and the author. He wrote the new book, Wisconsin's Wild Lakes. And John, getting a little bit of perspective here, from your, in your opinion, how have these lakes in Wisconsin been able to stay wild?
Well, a place is a space with a story, right? So there's a story with every one of these lakes of why they got saved. The problem with that I found was I couldn't find the stories. Those are stories to be teased down. And I'm hoping as part of this book that I'll get lots of emails and phone calls from people saying, you know what, I got the story on this lake and I'd love to tell you. And then I can hopefully do future editions and say, okay, here, let's fill out this story, because this, I'd love to just to know why every lake has a specific name. I found a few, but somebody gave a name to this place. Why is this one lake called Grandma Lake? Well, who is Grandma?
Yes.
Why is this one called Jenny Lake? Well, who the hell was Jenny? So that kind of stuff. And then I wanted as well to try to find the original Ojibwa names.
Oh.
Because I thought that would be fascinating, because usually that would describe in some manner what the lake was known to them for.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found a few, but by and large, the wild lakes that are left are small lakes that weren't, they may have been named, but those names have been lost. The names that I did find are attached to much larger, are more beautiful lakes that are, of course, were the first developed. So we have quite a few Ojibwa names known, but again, for developed lakes. So I wasn't able to give the many lakes at all their original Ojibwa names for the wild lakes I described in the book.
But one of the central themes to these wild lakes, John, seems to be the public lands are available for all of us to access these waters.
Right.
And the fact that they're to some degree protected for natural habitat and wild animals.
Yeah, you know, we used to have back in the late 1990s and into the early 2000s a program to actually purchase more of these public properties, or they would be private properties at the time, but then bring them into public ownership. It was a Wild Lakes program. And one of the things I advocate for in the book is a reinstatement of that particular program. It's expensive to buy shoreland, but what I found were quite a number of lakes that had only one owner, and it may in some cases be an entire lake owned by one person, but it may also have been a lake with just one small inholding of 10% of the shoreline, 90% state owned. It would be wonderful if we could somehow pungle up the money and say, this matters to us. Let's increase the number. Because I found really not very many, a very small percentage of lakes left in northern Wisconsin that are wild. And those that I found were generally smaller, generally very shallow, and often silty, mucky kind of bottoms that were the least desirable to be developed. Now, I happen to love those lakes because they're full of waterfowl, full of songbirds, fabulous plant life, but they're not a place you're going to go water skiing or swimming necessarily. These are often bog or wetland kind of lakes. But anyway, I'd love to see us reinstitute that, because, you know, we're not making land anymore, and we're certainly not making lakes anymore. So let's protect what we can, all voluntarily, not having the DNR condemn anybody's property. But if someone's a willing seller, let's go for it.
John Bates, the author of Wisconsin's Wildest Lakes, joining us. And John, give me, as a Wisconsin naturalist, I'm curious what it's like for you to enter a lake for the first time. Give me some idea of what it's like to prepare to go into this lake for the first time and how you are trying to document it to share with others.
When you first, you know, pull up to a lake and you're unloading your boat, there's all this excitement and anticipation as a general rule. And what I have to remind myself anyway is to breathe. Just slow down. I've probably driven 55 miles an hour to get to this place, you know, and I'm finally there and I'm just excited. And I have to try to belong. I have to be a part of a place. And the only way I'm a part of a place is if I shut my mouth for one, don't make any further noise. And I need to shut my brain off too. I don't need to be present. I need to be in the moment. And that sometimes takes a little while, and I didn't always succeed in that, but that's what I would ask everybody to do, you know, or try to do when you come to a wild place like this, is to sit along the shore maybe for a little while, calm yourself, try to just listen, try to be a part of the place, not to be a broadcaster of all of your noise and bang, bang, and, you know, you're hitting your paddle against your boat, so, you know, all that kind of stuff, but rather be a receiver, be that person who is hearing and seeing everything, and going slow along the shoreline. Just go really slow. We're taught as kids to quit poking around. We need to teach ourselves as adults to start poking around. We need to really poke around slow, look at things. That's a skill that very few people have. We tend to want to get from point A to point B and say we did it. Well, the exploration of these wild lakes isn't an endpoint that you're seeking. You're seeking all the things in between and having a relationship to them, having some connection to them, having a deeper appreciation for them. So I think that's what I call for people to do in the introduction, to approach these places with as peaceful and as quiet a mind as they can, and to not be approaching them as a resource opportunity. I want to catch as many fish as I can or shoot as many ducks as I can. People can do that by all means and will do that. But I hope that's a secondary thought. I hope that the first and foremost thought is to love the beauty, just fall in love with these places, and be healed by them. Frankly, I think the world needs a whole lot of healing these days, and needs a lot of inspiration. And these wild places provide both that healing and inspiration.
John, thank you for sharing the beauty with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was WPR's Lee Rayburn talking to naturalist John Bates about his book, Wisconsin's Wild Lakes, A Guide to the Last Undeveloped Natural Lakes.